Welcome to today's SNEB webinar, first webinar of 2021. Welcome. Glad you're joining us today for a presentation sponsored by the Healthy Aging Division. My name is Rachel Dager. I'm the Executive Director of SNEB. A little bit of housekeeping to get us started. If you look in the GoToWebinar toolbar, you'll see a tab that says Handouts. Today's presentation is posted there as a PDF, so you're welcome to download that to take notes during the presentation. We will take questions at the end of the presentation, so please type those in the question block so I can moderate them to our presenters. And then when I close out the webinar today, there's a short survey that pops up, and we appreciate your feedback on this session as well as ideas for future sessions. So our presenters today, Dr. Catherine Colasa is Professor Emerita, Brody School of Medicine at East Carolina University. She's an SNEB past president and represented SNEB on the Osteoarthritis Action Alliance. Tova Wolf is an assistant professor in the School of Health Sciences at Western Carolina University. I'll turn it over to them.
Rachel, before you go, tell us about the quilt behind you.
Oh, I'm in the SNEB office officially today. A lot of times you see me at home, but the quilt behind me was designed, I think, by Roberta Dyfe's students for the 30th anniversary conference. So that was about 25 years ago. They're little hand-painted squares. They did an auction, and the quilt was intended to always hang in the SNEB office. So there it is.
Thank you. And it's good to be here. As Rachel said, I'm Kathy Colasa, and a past president of SNEB. And we got into this discussion about osteoarthritis because SNEB was asked to join the Osteoarthritis WAKE Committee. The Osteoarthritis Alliance is headquartered in Chapel Hill, and you might want to look them up. They have, until now, not really worried very much about nutrition or even weight. They had been working a lot on physical activity, and as they have ventured into the area of nutrition and nutrition education, we have participated. Neither Tova or I have a conflict of interest. Tova is active in the Healthy Aging Division. I'm still a member of SNEB, but not working as much as I used to, so I'm not quite as active as I used to be either. Next slide. Here are the nutrition educator competencies that for those of you who are using those and identifying them, 3.4, 8.7, and 9.4. Next slide. Our goal includes making sure you're aware of the evidence for dietary strategies such as weight management and eating approaches and dietary supplements to prevent, retard, or manage symptoms of osteoarthritis in humans. I might say that Tova and I did this seminar, a shortened version of it for the Osteoarthritis Alliance. And so some of this we're still going to show you because we'll talk about how nutrition educators might deal with these issues. But these were, in fact, the aims of the shorter webinar for people who were not in nutrition. So we wanted to make sure you're aware, if you aren't already, that there are some features of the new dietary supplement label you might want to pay attention to. Since people who have osteoarthritis take a lot of supplements. Be able to briefly describe a simple handout how to do the Mediterranean approach to eating, how to assess the Mediterranean approach to eating in your own way, and then be aware of some of our nutrition education resources. I actually surveyed through the SNEES earlier in the year who had nutrition education resources on osteoarthritis and found very little available. Next slide.
All right. Hello, all. This is Tova, and I'm very sorry I can't get my camera working. OA, so osteoarthritis, and I'm going to use the word OA. So it affects 32.5 million adults in the U.S. So that's 1 in 7 U.S. adults. It's associated with aging, and it's more common among people who have chronic conditions such as heart disease, diabetes, and obesity. Over half of the adults with OA, so about 18.7 million are of working age, so between the ages of 18 and 64. And more specifically, what is OA? So it's it's the most common form of arthritis in adults. And some people call it degenerative joint disease or the wear and tear arthritis. It frequently occurs in the hands, the knees, and the hips. And with OA, the cartilage within the joint, which I'll show on the next slide, it begins to break down and the underlying bone begins to change. And these changes develop slowly and get worse over time. And it can cause pain, stiffness, and swelling. And in some cases, it also reduces function and disability. And some people aren't able to do daily tasks or work. What is really interesting to find is if you dive into the research, most studies focus on arthritis in general and not specifically OA, which is interesting because OA is the most common form of arthritis. So what are the risk factors for OA? So joint injury or overuse. So such as knee bending and repetitive stress on the joint, this can damage the joint and increase the risk of OA developing in that joint. As we all know, age, the older you get, the higher chance of OA developing. Women are more likely to develop OA than men, especially after the age of 50. And I didn't put it up here. I must have missed it. But obesity, so extra weight puts more stress on the joints, particularly the weight-bearing joints, like the hips and the knees. And genetics, people who have family members with OA are more likely to develop it. And race as well, showing some people from Asian populations have a lower risk of OA. And so the signs and symptoms are showed right here. And since it's so prevalent, most of us know people who have OA or have OA. All right, so.
So for those of you who don't know me, I've had a career the last 30 years in teaching medical students, house staff, practicing physicians. And for the most part, it's been pretty difficult to get their attention about diet. A, because it takes a long time to talk to a patient about diet. But more importantly, they have been so excited about giving medicines to people that a medicine, taking a quick pill, might do something better or more easily than following what you're eating. But there's now this, not only with osteoarthritis, but other conditions as well, more interest in looking at diet because of the opioid epidemic. Healthcare professionals and consumers are looking for alternative approaches to reducing pain and to improving function in lots of different conditions, but in particular osteoarthritis. And that's partly why the Osteoarthritis Alliance is interested in some of these things as well. At this point, the expert recommendations for managing osteoarthritis or symptoms of osteoarthritis is to lose some weight. You'll see in our discussion that they don't necessarily recommend or discuss other dietary approaches. So weight loss all by itself, and sometimes without even talking about the quality of the diet that you might use for weight loss. So today we're going to discuss the evidence of the Mediterranean eating approach because of that. Next slide. There are actually two diets that there are some little bit of evidence, and I'm going to, and probably Tova will mention this as well, that there isn't a lot of data yet about Mediterranean or DASH or any other of the dietary approaches, but there is some. And because the Mediterranean diet has a systematic review by Morales and co-workers, we're going to spend most of the time talking about that. There are some limited data to show improved quality of life. DASH has a little bit of data related to reduction in pain and improvement in function. And my favorite diet these days for people who have osteoarthritis and are typically a little older, as well as myself, all of us who are trying to stem off the memory loss that we all tend to have some of is the MIND diet, M-I-N-D. And I did a webinar for SNEB in the spring or late spring about the MIND diet. It's not been studied in OA yet, but I believe that we probably would find the same kind of benefits. Next slide. Quality of fat is what's been looked at a little bit in terms of OA. Saturated fat, increasing pain, decreasing function. Polyunsaturated fats, decreasing pain, increasing function. Omega-3s, decreasing pain and increasing function. And then interesting, there's one report with olive oil and canola oil of retarding cartilage destruction. So paying attention to quality of fat, that's a message that you can give to your consumers about fat and osteoarthritis. Next slide. Interestingly, that there have been a couple of researchers who've been looking at carbohydrates, partly because of weight loss or the intent to lose weight with a low carb diet or a high carb diet or a high protein diet. And the studies have varied a little bit from 2011 to 2020. Probably kind of matching the way people were interested in carbs and protein diets or high fat diets. What was shown in one of the studies is that the type of carbohydrate, a really low carbohydrate diet, would reduce the pain intensity, would reduce the unpleasantness that some people have when they are functioning using their hands, that they reduce the self-reported pain. And there was even a laboratory response. The one problem I have with the carbohydrate approach, though, is that even if this worked out in science, that you really could have a very low carbohydrate diet to improve your osteoarthritis symptoms, you can't really follow a low carbohydrate diet forever. And really, when we're looking at a dietary or eating approach to reduce pain, improve function, you need to do it every day or consistently over time. Next slide.
All right, so what about fiber? So if we look at the literature that's, the more recent literature that's out there, there are a handful that have demonstrated that higher fiber intakes are associated with less OA symptoms and pain in a dose response manner. And individuals with the highest fiber intake in a study had a 61% lower risk of symptomatic OA. And looking more into that, those with the highest cereal fiber intake had a 14% lower risk of pain worsening than those in the lower intake groups of fiber. All right, moving on to protein. A low-calorie, high-protein diet is associated with improved function capacity. And there was a large randomized control study done that combined diet and exercise program and looked at pain and quality of life. And it they had greater improvements than either the diet or exercise-only groups. Though, unfortunately, combined diet and exercise programs tend to have worse adherence than diet-only programs. All right, Kathy already touched on weight loss, but we're gonna talk about it again. So review of literature finds support for different types of weight loss to reduce pain and improve function. And for some time, it has been understood that excess weight impacts function. Most of the research has been done, that's already been done, is related to knee and hip. More recently, the idea that changes in weight might have a metabolic effect means that improvement in pain and function might also happen with hand OA. So with a 10% weight loss, there's seen to be less pain and inflammation, better function, improved quality of life, reduced knee joint load, and 20% or even better for some of the participants. And it's demonstrated to work in all three of these approaches of these bullets here. So when calorie restricted using food only, or calorie restricted using meal replacement shakes and foods, or calorie restriction combined with exercise. Fruits and vegetables, of course. Independent benefits of fruit and vegetables shown on OA. And so far, there seems to be a stronger quality of evidence to support high fruit intake that is available for than the high vegetable intake, but they do show their independent benefit. Kathy touched on this too. There does need to be more research. Most of the research on diet quality and OA management has been observational. And so we cannot state causality between the two, though we do recommend with the body of evidence that's out, a high quality diet, specifically one lower in saturated fats, higher in unsaturated fats and omega-3 fatty acids, and higher in fruits, vegetables, and dietary fiber. All right, so we're gonna go now shift to getting into more of the specifics of med eating and how you might be able to show this to your clients. So there's no gold standard for the Mediterranean diet if you try to find it. You'll see these different themes. But there is some talk of there's these 16 countries that border the Mediterranean, and eating styles vary among the countries, and they even vary based on culture, ethnic background, economy, geography, religion, and egg production. However, there seems to be some common threads that are going on. And so what are these common things that these Mediterranean countries tend to do? They typically have a higher intake of fruits, vegetables, whole grains, and beans. They typically have more of those mono and polyunsaturated fats. They typically have more of an intake of seafood, and they moderate things like poultry and dairy, so not too much, just right. And they try to limit red meat to less than one time per week. And so typically, if you look up sources, which we will share some later, with the mono and polys, the total fat is typically 25 to 35% of calories, and limited to 7 to 8% of calories coming from saturated fats. And these are not inclusive lists. This is just to share some examples. So if we look at the US, what does it take to go Mediterranean in the US? So this is pulled from the updated dietary guidelines. And you will see the cup equivalent for vegetables, fruits, grains, dairy, protein, and oils. And then if you look on the right, so this is a considered a Mediterranean food pyramid. And just showing it to show, you'll notice, it has exercise on it. And as we go to the top, it shows what we should have less of. So you'll notice, notice also alcohol in moderation, just a little different than what you might have seen before. So if you're wanting to look at a plate, this is a great visual for a starting point. And so this is out of Vidant Health, for instance, healthcare providers can use this and hand it out to their patients. And you'll notice half that plate is fruits and vegetables, a quarter that meats is that healthy protein. And then we've got a quarter of that plate, those healthy grains. We also have the nuts and seeds, water, unsweet tea, moderation of wine, and also dairy. So from the prior two slides, the key messages we can take away is the Mediterranean eating approach includes a large amount of food from plant sources. And the thought is because when people are eating Mediterranean diet, they're getting a lot more, plant fiber. So they may actually consume fewer calories than if they were eating the traditional Western diet, and thus weight loss. Although this plan emphasizes eating minimally processed, fresh, and locally grown foods, patients and clients should be told they can also get nutritional benefit from canned, frozen, and dry fruits and vegetables. This approach may be slightly higher in fat than previously recommended by the American Heart Association, but the emphasis is using healthy fats. For instance, olive oil, canola oil, we know there's many healthy fats out there. Moderate amounts of lower fat cheese and low or no fat yogurt are recommended for their nutrition. And although data do not support the use of, Kathy will get to that. So I'm going to move on. All right. So this is another way. This is out of Vital Health again. They have some great resources. So this is another method that can be used to see if people are adhering to the Mediterranean eating. And so reading across the table, you can go through each food group and you have your client circle, how many times or how many portions do I feel like I am eating of whole grains per day, vegetables, fruits, legumes. And then you're given a score and then you add up each category for the foods. And if you're 33 to 44, you're following the med eating. If you're 11 to 32, there are some changes you need to make to eat the Mediterranean way. And if you're 0 to 10, you have many changes to make. All right, so after you, find your score or your client, here are some simple 7 steps. And you can pick one you want to work on first. And I encourage you or your patients to only focus on one step at a time and for a defined period of time before moving on to a different one. And there's a lot of resources to show patients or yourself how to do this. And so what are those steps? So change your protein. So step one pretty much describes switching to healthier types of protein. Swap your fats. We already talked about using those healthy oils. Eat more vegetables. Eat more fruit. Why not snack on some nuts or seeds instead of having that candy dish on the desk? Aim to make those grains whole and rethink your sweets. And I just wanted to show you this great website that's from Carolyn Dunn and Dr. Carolyn Dunn and others. If you're at all a visual person like me, if you don't want to read the prior slide, they have these great 2 to 3 minute videos for each step, which can be really, really helpful for clients. And so depending on which one they want to work on, they just click it and then a wonderful video and some tips on how to do that. All right, so in assisting clients and patients with doing this, we like to put out there, of course, refer to a registered dietitian whenever using lower calorie diets. And if your patient is our client is interested in learning the ways of med eating. In most states now, no referral is necessary. And if you go to that website, you can find RDNs in your area. The best way to personalize this diet to your patient's preferences and budget, et cetera, and how elements of their current dietary pattern may be able to be incorporated into Mediterranean eating. Many insurance policies cover the visit, especially if an individual needs to lose weight. So check with your, encourage your patients or clients to check with their insurance company to see if it's covered. All right, so I just quickly want to take you through a case of a typical day for today's Dan. So we're gonna go ahead and get a 24-hour recall from Dan and ask him what he ate. And so this is typical, and he had a typical day yesterday. So for breakfast, he typically has a stack of pancakes. For lunch. He typically has a 12-inch sub with a side of chips. And for dinner, he has a big plate of pasta with some marinara and meatballs. And he always likes to have dessert as well. So I want you to think for a second, what are, just thinking about those seven steps, what are some ways that Dan might be able to incorporate Mediterranean eating? Okay, so one thing I forgot to mention is he keeps Reese's Pieces in his desk drawer and bags of chips. So we might focus on snacks. So we might try to see if he likes Reese's Pieces, he might absolutely like nuts and seeds. And so he might be willing to rethink some of those sweets. He might be willing to replace fruit for dessert or to help increase fruit. Might set a goal to increasing more vegetables. And so you might show him for meals like this or this or this, showing that plate we showed before might be a good place to start. All right, so in short, should clients, patients go Mediterranean? So if we look at the data that's out so far, we show that there's decreased, they show that there's decreased oxidative stress in the OA and decreased interleukin 6 levels. In fact, research supports it's more effective in aiding in weight loss than low fat diets. Long-term weight loss, so 10 to 20% of baseline, shows improved health quality related of life while reducing pain and increasing function. And US News World Report 2020, and for a second year, it's considered the best overall diet and the easiest way to follow, in the easiest diet to follow. In addition, it has shown, if you look at the research for other chronic diseases, it shows a reduced risk of cardiovascular disease, decreased risks of some types of cancers, protective against cognitive decline, decreased risk of type 2 diabetes. Though we want everyone to keep in mind, many of these studies are observational, and there is room for more research to be done in this area. All right, so if you are a community nutrition educator, how do we get families to MedE? So numerous studies have shown that the development of food preferences is significantly influenced by eating environments during childhood and adolescence. During childhood, food preferences are developed, and parental dietary habits highly play an influential role. And so just wanted to emphasize that nutrition education and modification should begin at a young age as well as be aimed at adults and older adults, right? Because of that parental and grandparent influence. All right, there's a lot of resources out there. So we wanted to provide you with some that shows clear and concise information about med eating in a useful way. So as I said before, NC State Dr. Carolyn Dunn, the Meds Instead of Meds website, this is a great resource. I like making recipes from there as well. It's super fun, so I highly recommend that y'all check that out. There's also some a great manual, and there's at the UNCCH Center of Health Promotion and Disease Prevention on it. There's also a great video, longer than those, I think it's about 20 minutes, from the NC State Eat Smart, Move More, Weigh Less, and that link is provided right there. And also, one of the figures we shared, there is the Old Ways website, which we've provided right here. And also, we have resources and references for this presentation available upon request. Just shoot me an email and I can send those over if you would like them.
Hello again. Obviously, if we're talking about osteoarthritis, and I mentioned earlier that lots of people take supplements, we can't not review what's known about those. Next one, Tova.
Okay, just a second, sorry.
Okay. In 2019, the American College of Rheumatology Arthritis put out clinical practice guidelines, and they were quite clear in their recommendation against fish oil, vitamin D, glucosamine, chondroitin for knee and hip. They did say that there was some conditional recommendation for chondroitin sulfate for hand. But as you and I know, dietary supplements respond to different people in different ways. Next slide. So I'm going to show you what's been put in the literature. There's a little bit of data, not a lot, but a little bit of data that glucosamine sulfate will work for women for the prevention of knee issues, knee pain. There's some data about glucosamine and chondroitin sulfate combinations for both men and women. The controversy continues, and the controversy sits around more like what is the dosage and who will benefit rather than there is benefit or not. The third one that's on the slide is turmeric or curcumin, where there is some evidence, but without a definitive dosage, in a supplementation form for some pain relief. People have asked me, does the spice itself work? And the spice might, except that you can't day in and day out usually use the amount that would be required to get that pain reduction. Next slide. Here's another one that is listed with a little bit of data, oral hyaluron, that has been approved for injection in the knee. There's been some discussion of it as a supplement, but it's not yet really widely available. There are a variety of functional foods that have been studied a little bit. Again, each one of these, there was one study or two studies, three studies, nothing terribly definitive about avocado, strawberries, pomegranate juice, fish oils, probiotics. But because there are a little bit of data, you know that consumers are going to see them, hear them, think about them. Vitamin C, limited study, about 200 milligrams, 150 for women, decreasing pain. Vitamin D, early studies show some possibility of benefit if a person is deficient, and deficient meaning less than 30 mg per ml. So we don't really know, and one of our roles as nutrition educators is to help people understand the risks and benefits of supplementing, as well as to encourage them to get high quality products if they're going to. Next slide. We hear a lot about the new nutrition facts label. I have struggled a little bit to find information for consumers about the new supplement facts label. So I wanted to point that out to you that in case you aren't aware that the supplement label has been updated, and I'm showing this one on glucosamine and chondroitin for a couple of reasons. One is that you'll see the top list item is sodium on the facts label, and that's because there is a daily value for sodium. On reading the supplement facts label, you'll see a big black line. Everything above it has to have a daily value. Anything that does not have a daily value will be below that black line. And at this point in time, about 50% of dietary supplements have a DV. So you're not going to find it on a lot of things. It used to be that there were only 19 vitamins and minerals with daily values. There now are 27. So there will be more of those items that are above that black line. But I think it's important for you to be aware and to be able to help your consumers if they're asking you about it. There is no DV for omega-3 fatty acids, for example, so they're going to be down there just like glucosamine is. There are no herbs or botanicals that have a daily value. And some dietary supplements are metabolites, constituents, extracts, isolates, or combos of all those, and none of them have daily values. So that's a little bit of why the label looks the way it does. Next slide. We mentioned vitamin D as being an issue or concern or a possibility of helping and reduce the pain and improving function. And so people are supplementing with vitamin D for lots of reasons. I have had patients call me recently who are confused about the label because on the new label, it is required that they be in micrograms, listed in micrograms, and only optionally labeled in IUs. And many of our patients had been buying all of their vitamin D in IUs, and they're a little bit confused. So making sure that they're getting the right dose is really important. Next slide.
All right, so we already talked about potential hands-on nutrition education approaches, but what can be done to further implement med eating? So we just wanted to do a quick review on those SMART goals. All right, so just to recap, what is SMART? When we're setting a SMART goal, it's specific. It's exactly once what a client wants to accomplish. It's measurable, so there's concrete steps to allow the client to track their process. And at the end of each milestone, they'll know how far away they are from reaching their goal. It's attainable, so it's something they know they can achieve because it's within reach and they are physically and mentally capable of doing it. It's relevant to them, so it means a lot, and achieving it will prove to them that they are strong and an independent person, the strong and independent person they know they can be. It's time bound, so it has an end date to work towards with multiple dates as checkpoints along the way. And an easy way to do this is to do an action plan. And so an example format would be right here for you. So you could ask your client, what would you like to do? Where, when, and how often will you do this? How long or how much, and when will you start? And if we were to look at that, really common in my practice as a dietitian, a lot of people desire to increase their intake of vegetables. So I want to eat more vegetables. Well, where? Home. And how? When and how often will you do this? So making sure they give you specific details. So for instance, 3 days per week for lunch and dinner meal might be a good place to start. How long and how much? They may want to add at least one serving of vegetables to lunch and dinner meal. And when will you start? Some may mention next Monday because I'm going grocery shopping Sunday night. All right, there's this misconception that it's expensive to eat healthy. We don't believe that as dietitians. So you can do Mediterranean eating on a budget. So these are some nice, easy steps you can do if med eating on a budget. So when people shop with a list, make a grocery list, and they stick with it, having that list tends to help prevent some impulse buying, right? And I don't know about all you, but I like to go grocery shopping after I've eaten a meal. So I do less of that impulse buying. Two, plan ahead. Encourage your clients to plan ahead and make that shopping list. And that can also save money and reduce food waste because there's a plan for every item that they're buying. We also encourage people to buy in bulk if they're trying to save. Med eating, especially because you can get in bulk things like nuts, whole grains, dried beans, spices. And at most grocery stores, you can usually find them in bulk. You can also shop the sales. Many of us get ads in the mail, but also a lot of stores these days have apps that will provide you coupons. Items like canned and dried beans and whole grains and nuts have a pretty shelf stable. Fish often goes on sale and freezes well, so be sure to stock up on that if it's at a good price. And frozen fruits and vegetables are great options as well, especially if they're not in season. And we also encourage people to check out their CSA, so community supported agriculture. It's a great option if you're following Mediterranean eating, because it includes a large amount of those plant foods like fruits and vegetables. And we also recommend people to prep food at home. So although they're convenient, those pre-chopped fruits and veggies tend to be significantly more expensive. If you can afford them, great. If you can't, and if you have time and you're able, skip items like the cut up fruit and shredded carrots and prepared items, and opt to chop, shred, or slice at home. Also, there are many, and I have some family members who have OA. I've seen some of these devices work great. There's adaptive devices that can be purchased that can make food prep a lot easier for people who have OA that affects their hands. All right, so here are some osteoarthritis care tools and resources if you would like to learn more. And with that, we'd like to thank you for attending today's STEB webinar sponsored by the Healthy Aging Division. And at this time, Rachel will take the questions.
Excellent. Thank you very much. I do have a couple of questions. So as I read these off to our presenters, just if you have a question, go ahead and type that in the question block. So the first question is, what is the med recommendation with regard to fruit juices?
That's a great question. Kathy, correct me if I'm wrong. The emphasis is on whole fruits and vegetables.
That is true. It is. Did you look at the new chart you put up with the dietary guidelines? Is it in there?
Yeah, let's pull that up to see. I actually put that in today. So
yeah, I forgot. A lot of us haven't had a lot of time yet to study all those things. Have they specified juices in there?
No, they have not. Yeah, that's a great question. I will let you know if I find any information on that. Rachel, if you wouldn't mind taking down their information.
Yeah, I can share that out and have you get back to them.
Yes.
Another question, is there evidence for vitamin D content along with calcium if on a med diet? And then also, has the scoring table been tested, validated?
I can answer that. That particular scoring chart was not validated. It has been used less of a research and more of a quick clinical or educational system. It was based on a research paper that was in the Journal of American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. So it was derived from that, but it has not in itself been tested. What was the other part of that, Rachel?
The first part, is there evidence for vitamin D content along with calcium?
I'm sorry, I'm not following.
It says, is there evidence for vitamin D content along with calcium if on a med diet?
If on a med diet. Well, I would think what you would end up wanting to do is making sure whatever you're eating, be it a Mediterranean DASH or any other anti-inflammatory diet, that you are looking at the nutrients that you're getting. If you're getting sufficient D, then you don't need supplements. If you're getting sufficient calcium, you don't need supplements. The literature related to osteoarthritis is in fact that if it's deficient, if you're deficient, not getting enough, if your blood levels are too low, you might need a supplement or additional foods that have vitamin D in them and some sunshine.
Sunshine is nice. Agreed.
Yeah. We don't have any here today. So
actually, Indianapolis has some sunshine today. So I'm enjoying that.
Good for you. We had yesterday a beautiful sunshiny day, but not today.
Another question, is there any evidence of that hydration is a risk for OA?
I did quite an extensive lit review. We've got actually a paper that will be coming out in Nutrition Today probably this summer, and I didn't see hydration anywhere in that literature. Tova, did you see anything in the literature you reviewed on hydration?
No, not specific to OA, but I do like looking at hydration research because I'm a big hydration advocate. And there is some research with hydration and other certain chronic diseases, but I haven't dived in looking for OA. A great question.
Yeah, we'll have to take a look, but I hadn't seen anything specific to that.
Excellent. We still have time for a few more questions if anyone wants to type those in the question block. I will mention that during the speaker introductions, I mentioned that Kathy had served as the SNEB representative to the Osteoarthritis Action Alliance, and we are currently searching for a new spokesperson. Kathy, if you wanted to share what the responsibilities for that position were.
All right. The Osteoarthritis Alliance, Action Alliance, has two main goals. One is to provide good information to people, consumers, patients, about osteoarthritis. The other is to actually develop and support educating healthcare professionals about osteoarthritis, developing materials and those sorts of things. One of the things that they do currently is a lunch and learn every month. It's a 30-minute lunch and learn on their website, and you might want to take a look if that's of interest to you. The reason SNEB and the American Academy and the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics and the American Society for Nutrition were invited to join the Alliance is because all of the work they had been doing was on physical activity and medications, and now felt the need to move into the area of weight management and nutrition. And so they invited us to join in, and SNEB did. The representative attends a short meeting, a half hour meeting once a month. Then as appropriate, they might decide to do as I did early on, was to try to survey through SNEES who had nutrition education materials already available that could be put on the OAA website to share broadly with both consumers and with the professional body. And as I mentioned, I've got very little, and as I look, there really hasn't been very much done in terms of nutrition education materials related to OA. So then they started a survey to identify what would professionals want in terms of nutrition education materials, weight management materials. And they are currently involved in collecting that data to decide what the group will next do. And so the representative from SNEB would be participating in that review of the literature, review of the survey, and then either helping develop materials or helping recruit other SNEB members to participate in the development of materials. They have on other occasions found grant money to support those activities. Don't know if they will on this one or not. It's still kind of in that early stages, but they clearly want to do nutrition education. And so it seems to me we really need to be at the table.
Excellent. Yeah, if someone's interested in, you know, more information or volunteering to be that point person, shoot me an email and I would be happy to make that happen. We have one more question. Are the consumer education materials from Vidant Health in the public domain?
We have the right and ability to share those with you. The only thing we ask is if you're using them, that you would leave the credit line from Vidant Health on there. They were developed by the dietitian group from Vidant Health and the Brody School of Medicine, and we're happy to share them broadly.
Excellent. I don't see any other questions, although we still have time. Just a reminder that when I close out the webinar, there'll be a short survey that pops up. And we appreciate your feedback on that. And then watch for an email I would say probably Friday of this week, which includes a link to the recording, the handout for today, as well as your CEU certificate. And so if there's no other questions, I will thank our presenters and close things up. We actually already have quite a few webinars scheduled for the spring. So please check the SNEB website for those. And then also we're organizing the Spring Journal Club to be a series of educational webinars on research methods. And we hope to kick that off by late February. So watch for that announcement as well. Thank you all for attending today.